From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new documentary, This Film Is Not Yet Rated, investigates the MPAA's secretive and anonymous board that assigns films their ratings, G, PG, PG-13, R, and NC-17. The documentary also explains why some filmmakers consider the current rating system a form of censorship. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the film's director, Kirby Dick. He teamed up with a detective to attempt to uncover who sits on the board and how they operate. The chair of the board, Joan Graves, is not anonymous. We'll talk with her about why the ratings board operates the way it does. Also, we'll hear from actor Jeremy Sisto. He's best known for his role as Billy on 6 Feet Under. He's now starring in the new series Kidnapped. That's all coming up on Fresh Air, First the News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This Film Is Not Yet Rated is a new documentary about the secretive board that gives movies their ratings, G, PG, PG-13, R, and NC-17. These ratings were created in 1968 by Jack Valenti, who was the president of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America. The goal was to help parents decide what was appropriate for children. But to some filmmakers, the ratings seem like a form of censorship. They can determine who can see your movie and which theaters will show it. And NC-17 means no children under 17 admitted. That rating, which replaced the X, can translate to commercial death. Directors who get an NC-17 often try to change it to an R by re-editing the offending scenes, attempting to meet standards they find arbitrary and unclear. The MPAA Ratings Board operates in secret and won't even reveal the members' names. The director of the new documentary, Kirby Dick, challenges the system by teaming up with a private investigator and trying to uncover who these board members are. Dick says that some of the ways the board evaluates sex scenes, like timing the length of an orgasm, is ridiculous. I asked him what else he finds ridiculous.
Well, they count the number of thrusts, and as far as we can tell, 3 is sometimes okay, 4 is usually crossing the line. That would be one of them. They certainly count the use of language, which in some cases I think is appropriate. But I think their rating system is really very much excessively focused on things like language and sex, and not strongly focused enough on things like violence. In Europe, it's the opposite. Violence is of much more concern to the rating systems there than is sexuality.
One of the things you do in the movie is compare different scenes that are similar but got different ratings. So let me ask you to do that with two movies that you juxtapose, American Beauty and I'm a Cheerleader.
Well, what we did is we went to the sex scenes in American Beauty and in But I'm a Cheerleader, which is a film made by Jamie Babbitt. It's about two girls who actually go to a sexual reorientation camp. And it's a comedy, so they naturally fall in love. And so we took a shot from the sex scene of But I'm a Cheerleader and compared it to a shot of American Beauty. Nearly the identical frame and the identical shots. But I'm a Cheerleader received an NC-17 rating and American Beauty received an R rating. And this is part of the kind of a wider argument, which is, and that people have known this for a long time, is that films with gay sex and gay sexual content get more restrictive ratings than films with straight sex and straight sexual content. And I was appalled by this.
One of the films that you talk about in your movie is Team America, which was made by the guys who do South Park, and it's a film without actors. All of the performers in it are mannequins.
They're all like, right. Dolls, like, yes.
They're all dolls. And so there's this actually very funny sex scene in which the dolls are engaging in every conceivable and inconceivable position. What did the filmmakers tell you about how that scene was dealt with in the ratings board? I mean, because these aren't actors. These are just dolls.
Right. Well, we interviewed Matt Stone for our film, and he had already had an experience with the ratings board when he submitted Orgasmo, and which, again, is a funny, you know, kind of playful film about sex and really didn't deserve an NC-17 rating. But when he submitted that film to get a rating, he was told he was not given any specifics of what he should cut to get the R rating. So, and when he went ahead and submitted South Park, this time being made for a studio, he got a response that each, he got a line-by-line response of what he needed to cut in order to achieve an R rating. He then went on, so he's already had this experience with the ratings board. He then went on to make Team America, and he knew that he'd sort of, might be pushing the envelope here a little bit and, you know, has spoken out very strongly against the ratings board. So what he did for this particular sex scene is he cut together a 3 or 4 minute sex scene with the most outrageous sex acts you really can imagine and put them all in there for the ratings board to view with the idea that the ratings board would cut back some, but he'd be able to leave in what he really wanted in. And this is a technique, by the way, that many filmmakers use. And I think that's in some ways very unfortunate that a filmmaker who's making, in some cases, you know, a piece of art has to resort to playing these games with the rating system in order to complete his art in the way that he wants to.
Why do you think that the rating system is harder for independent filmmakers than it is for studios?
Well, I think it's because the MPAA rating system, the Motion Picture Association of America, is the trade organization and lobbying arm for the six major film studios, which together control 95% of the film business. The MPAA oversees the ratings board, so the studios are much more familiar with the process. In fact, heads of production and post-production supervisors often have weekly contact with people on the ratings board, and are able to, over many years, and develop relationships with them, and are able to learn ways to get their films through the ratings process. And in some cases, you know, we interviewed an ex-rater, and he said that they're even able to influence the votes of the raters. Now, independent filmmakers have no idea that that kind of access even exists for studio filmmakers. And so they come into this situation completely naive and cold, and without any intermediaries to deal with this system.
The names of people who are actually on the ratings board are kept anonymous. So even if you're submitting a film, you don't know who the people are by name who are deciding. You hired a private investigator to actually find out who the people are on the ratings board. Why did you do that? And you filmed the private investigator tracking them and everything. Yes. It's a very dramatic thing to do for a movie, but it also, you could argue it's also unfair to the people whose lives you're investigating. So, you know, it's a big step to take. Why did you hire a private investigator?
Well, these raters are doing something that's in the public interest. In fact, the MPAA says that the rating system is for the public. Well, if it's for the public, it should be public. And these names never should have been kept secret. In Western Europe, all the raters' names are known, and the system works just fine. This is an attempt by the it's part of this incredible secrecy that they maintain, which allows the MPAA to keep control of the rating system and limit criticism of it, because people don't now know how it operates. So I thought that the MPAA has no right to keep these people secret, and they really don't. They have no legal right to keep these people secret. So and since they weren't going to give me that information, I, as a filmmaker, and as any kind, you know, as any, I think, investigative filmmaker would, I took it on to myself to find out those names. And the best way, of course, is to hire a private investigator. Everything I did with the private investigator was entirely legal. I worked with an attorney. It had to be legal because I was shooting it all. It was all going to be up on the screen as evidence, and, you know, I could only do something that was legal.
Okay, so now you know the names of the people. How does that help you, or how does that help the public, in your opinion?
Well, that was sort of a gesture of opening up the system. I mean, and it was something that was important in the dramatic arc of the film. I mean, you know, I am making a film. It's a very entertaining film. It's a very exciting film. At the same time, it's a very strong critique of censorship and media consolidation and the power of Hollywood, really.
Yeah, but you said it's important to know who the people are. They're not anonymous in other countries. So now that you know who they are, what difference does it make?
Well, one of the things we found out was that up until very recently, the MPAA had claimed that all the people on the board were parents with children ages 5 to 17. What we found out is nearly half of those people on the board did not have children ages 5 to 17, but in fact only had children in their 20s and 30s. And there is one person who we were not able to ascertain 100% even had children. Again, I mean, without this process being opened up, we just have to take the MPAA at its word. And there's no reason we should. I mean, the MPAA is a trade organization for corporations whose interest is the bottom line. So they're going to use anything at their disposal to make a profit. So we shouldn't take corporations at their word. That we do that at our peril.
You know, when you say it represents the industry, it's the Motion Picture Association of America. Who officially does it represent?
Well, it represents the six major film studios, which, again, control nearly 95% of the film business. It does not represent the independent distributors or independent production companies or, you know, foreign production companies.
The MPAA says the main function of the rating system is to inform parents about the, you know, what's in a movie and whether it's acceptable for their children. So what do you make of that argument?
Well, I think they're doing a very poor job of that. I think that's very important. I think that's a very important job of any ratings board. But what they do, for example, up until very recently, the only way they would inform parents as to what was in a film was just by a single letter rating, which doesn't tell you much about a film. And after much pressure, particularly from parents' groups and critics, they were compelled to actually add what is called a short descriptor, which has a short description of what's in a film. These descriptions are very unprofessionally developed. In fact, I would say that the ratings board itself may be the most unprofessional board operating in this country today. It has no professionally developed standards. It has essentially no written standards. The raters receive no training. They are hired one day and put in the ratings room the next and begin rating films. And there are no experts associated with the process. There are no media experts or child psychologists on the board. In fact, Jack Valenti has deliberately excluded them. Jack Valenti, during the time that, for the nearly 35 years, deliberately excluded them from being a part of the ratings process.
My guest is Kirby Dick, director of the new documentary, This Film Is Not Yet Rated. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kirby Dick, director of the new documentary, This Film Is Not Yet Rated. It's about the MPAA Ratings Board, which assigns films their ratings from G to NC-17. Well, since your film is about the movie ratings process and the people who actually do those ratings, I'd like you to walk us through the process of submitting a film for rating, and why don't we look at your film, This Film Is Not Yet Rated, which finally you decided to put out unrated, but you did submit it for a rating before it was actually completed. So tell us what the process was like. You know, walk us through that process.
Exactly. Well, about three-quarters of the way through making the film, I took the footage, which was really the interviews with, many directors, John Waters, Kevin Smith, Matt Stone, Kimberly Paris, excerpts from the films that had given those films initially NC-17 ratings, as well as the element where I followed the PI getting the raters' names. That was all put together into a very tight rough cut and submitted to the ratings board to get a rating. Now, the reason I did this was, there's a certain pleasure, certainly, I got in out of this, and there's a certain irony to it. But the real reason I did it was, the MPA is so secretive about its process, it was the only thing that I could do, the only way that I could find out what happened to a film when it went through the ratings process. Well, I submitted my film, and I did get an NC-17 rating. Now, to be fair to the ratings board, that actually was consistent with the way they had given other films with sexual content an NC-17 rating, because I included in my film excerpts from other films that had given those films the NC-17 rating.
Right. So that made sense. But what's the process like? Like, you give them the film, and then do you get a written report? Do they call you on the phone? Do they invite you in and talk with you? How does it work?
Well, you submit the film, and then you get a call back. In this case, I got a call back from Joan Graves. Nothing, though, is written.
She's the chairman of the ratings board.
She is the chairman of the ratings board. And nothing substantial is done in writing. The only thing that was done by email was scheduling, nothing else. So there was no written list at all. I mean, no acknowledgement, really. I mean, there was an acknowledgement that had come in, but no overall sort of analysis of how the raters responded to the film, what the vote was, what the particular issues were. Nothing like that was done in writing. It was all done verbally. Again, this is done so there's no record, so that a filmmaker cannot launch a critique of the ratings board vis-a-vis, in comparison to another filmmaker who might have gotten a less restrictive rating. So it was actually over several days, and again, this is documented in my film. I had a conversation on three separate occasions with Joan Graves about what was in my film, and she, I asked her specifically I was on camera. I asked her, "What do I need to take out to get an R rating?" And she wouldn't tell me. And I said, "Look, I think that's unfair to me, because I might, in cutting this down to get an R rating, might take out something that I didn't need to take out to get an R rating." And her response to me was basically that was the risk I had to take, because she wasn't going to get specific with me about what I needed to take out. Because she said if I did, that would be, quote-unquote, censorship. So in the end, I mean, I just, you know, accepted the NC-17 rating, and I moved to the next stage, which was the appeal stage.
What is the appeal like?
Well, the appeal stage was, I think, my closest experience to being in an Alice in Wonderland novel. Actually, it's really quite absurd. You cannot take the attorney of your choice in to assist you or represent you before the appeals board, even though an MPA attorney is chairing the appeals board session. They will not let you know who the people are on the appeals board, even though these people are making decisions about your film that may affect the film and may affect your career. In fact, when I went in there, everybody was wearing a number. It was as if it was out of that old 60s TV show, The Prisoner. In fact, I was asked to put on a number myself. My number was 22. And it was very absurd. I would go up to somebody and I would say, "Hi, my name is Kirby Dick. Could you introduce yourself?" And they would just pull their hand away and say nothing. In fact, I knew a couple of people in that ratings room and they would not identify themselves. And then what's in some ways most absurd is that you cannot use precedent to make your argument before the appeals board. You cannot say, "Look, my film has a particular scene in that's very similar to another film, and you rated that other film less restrictively. Therefore, I would like to make the argument that my film should get a less restrictive rating." As soon as you mention the other film, you are cut off.
How do the people who sit on the appeals board compare in terms of their how they're selected to the people who make the initial ratings decision?
Well, this is one of the things that I was very shocked to learn, is that all of the people on the appeals board, or nearly all of them, are executives high up in the film business. Most of them are either work for the studios or work for the major exhibition chains. And so these are people, it's the people very closely associated with the MPA and the rating process are making these decisions. There are a few independent positions. There's one representative of Landmark Theaters. There's one representative, I believe, from Lionsgate. But for the most part, it's made up of the powerhouse corporations within Hollywood.
One of the things that you discovered is that there are clergy on the appeals board. Would you describe the relationship there?
Yes, there's one member of clergy and another member who's representing a religious organization, and they've actually been involved in the process for many, many years. But it's a very strange situation because these people on the appeals board are asked to make a decision about a film, but there's a real moral tone that, you know, the presence of clergy brings. They don't vote, but they're there to observe. I mean, I don't know, perhaps they represent the eye of God. I don't know. And the reason they're there is because when the ratings board was initially set up, Jack Valenti received pressure from some religious groups. And Jack Valenti is a master lobbyist and deal maker. And he went to those religious organizations and said, "Okay, fine, I'll allow a couple of people to be on the appeals board, non-voting members." Now, there are only these two specific representatives. They are not, it's not a rotating position. There are no other rabbis, Muslims, or other denominations that are on the appeals board or can come on, rotate onto the appeals board. And the reason he did that was he was pressured when the ratings board was set up in 68 by some religious groups that who had criticisms of the ratings process. And so what he did, because he is a lobbyist and deal maker, is he went to those religious organizations and said, "You can be on the ratings board, but I'm going to do this in complete secret." And so the public is not aware of this, and neither is essentially anybody within the film industry as well. This came as a great shock to everybody.
You finally decided that instead of accepting the NC-17 rating, that you would let your film go unrated. Why? What's the advantage of that?
Well, the reason is that if you go out unrated, you have a lot of the same kind of restrictions that you have if you went out with an NC-17 rating, but they're not as severe. So it allows the film to play in a wider range of theaters. There are more newspapers that will advertise it, and it's more likely that it will get into Blockbuster or Walmart.
What changes would you like to see in the rating system?
Well, I would like to see it be transparent. There's no reason to keep it secret unless there's something to hide. I would like to see it be professionalized. I mean, this is rating films is a complex process that is very important to the American public and particularly to American parents. Let's have a professional system. And then finally, I would like to see a rating between the R in the NC-17. Roger Ebert has suggested an A. I think that makes a lot of sense because there's no reason that these films that are featured in my film and the many hundreds of others that have received NC-17 should be receiving a rating that is in essence a censorship of what of their work. And this should be available to the public so that it might be a rating where only people 18 and over can see it, but it doesn't have the stigma that's associated with an NC-17 attached to it.
What is that stigma?
Well, here's how the stigma developed. Originally, when the X rating was inaugurated, the MPAA did not copyright the X rating. And so very quickly, the pornography industry appropriated it with double X, triple X rating. And so the X rating became associated with pornography. When it was finally changed about a decade and a half ago to the NC-17 rating, after a great deal of pressure from filmmakers and critics, I might add, it wasn't the MPAA's initiative, when it was finally changed to an NC-17 rating, all that the MPAA did nothing to really disassociate the NC-17 from the X rating. So all the stigma associated with the X went over to the NC-17 rating. And so now what happens is that when people hear NC-17, they think pornography, they think sensationalistic. They think that a film, if it has sex or sometimes even violence, is that sex and violence is only in a film because filmmakers want to shock. And so mainstream audiences, and in particular mainstream independent audiences, stay away from that film.
Kirby Dick, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kirby Dick directed the new documentary, This Film Is Not Yet Rated. Later in the show, we'll hear from the chair of the MPAA Ratings Board. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Hollywood Records, presenting Indigo Girls' new album, Despite Our Differences, available in stores September 19th. More information at indigogirls.com. And from Universal Pictures, presenting The Black Dahlia, from the director of Scarface and the author of L.A. Confidential. The Black Dahlia, in theaters Friday. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Joan Graves, chair of the MPAA Ratings Board, responds to the documentary This Film Is Not Yet Rated. And actor Jeremy Sisto talks about playing the manic depressive Billy on 6 Feet Under, playing Jesus in a TV movie, and starring in the new NBC series Kidnapped. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We just heard from Kirby Dick, the director of the new documentary, This Film Is Not Yet Rated. It challenges the Motion Picture Association of America's rating system and investigates the secretive ratings board. The members of the board are anonymous, but the chair is not. She is my guest, Joan Graves. I asked her why her board members are anonymous, although there is no anonymity on ratings boards in many other countries. She pointed out that in other countries, those boards are mandated by law, whereas the MPAA ratings board is a voluntary organization and films are submitted on a voluntary basis. A problem with the idea of anonymous film raters on the board is that there's no way of challenging whether the members of that board are a fair representation of parents or American society or anything, because we don't know who they are.
Well, we do. We're happy to provide demographics with everything but their name. In other words, their age, their children, their prior occupations, and where they came from.
Are the parents on your board supposed to have any particular expertise in film or in the ratings of film? Are they media experts or child psychologists?
No, they're not.
Is that for a reason?
Yes, it's very specifically for a reason. They're supposed to rate a film the way they think most American parents would rate it. In other words, we're not supposed to set standards. We're supposed to reflect standards. So very definitely, they're supposed to represent parents, and all of us that are parents know that that our own children are very different. So if we can give information about the level of content in a film, then parents can make up their own mind about which of their children should see which film.
How does somebody get to be on the board? I mean, you don't run like classified ads, of the newspaper. How do people even know that there is such a thing? Do you go after people?
Sometimes we've gone after people, community leaders that have retired from boards of hospitals or libraries, and sometimes PTAs recommend people. They come to us from a wide variety of places. Usually, if someone calls up and asks to be on the rating board, many times he or she has a set agenda. So, and we don't want an agenda. We want someone that can reflect what they think most American parents would rate the film.
Now, on the ratings board, all the members are parents, and that's why they're selected. But on the appeals board, everybody on it, according to the movie This Film Is Not Yet Rated, everybody on that is tied in to the film industry, usually a representative of one of the studios or of one of the theater chains. What's the reason for that?
It was in 1968 when the system was formed. The members of the MPAA who were pledging to rate their product were a little bit concerned about a board that could have could run amok, and this was a check and balance. So if there were films that filmmakers questioned their rating, that they would have a place to go. But it's balanced in ways of a 2/3 vote requiring to override, and the standard is if the rating board appears to be clearly erroneous in applying the rating. Of the over 900 films we rate a year, less than 10 go to appeal, so it's not a process that's accessed very often.
Now, Kirby Dick discovered that there's a priest and a representative of a religious organization, I think it's the National Council of Churches, on the ratings appeals board. Why is that?
They are there as observers, and he's not a priest. But the Catholic Conference is represented in the National Council of Churches, and that is because when the system was formed in 1968, the church groups who had been very active in censorship boards across the country felt that the appeals board made up of industry types might be a little bit like the hen guarding the fox guarding the hen house. So they asked to be able to observe the appeals process, and Jack Valenti, who started the system, thought that would be a good way for them to assure themselves that everything is working as it should. They do not vote, and they do not make any comments. They're just there as observers.
So what's the point?
Well, just to assure their constituencies that the rating system has worked the way it was intended to work, as parents giving information to other parents.
Why isn't there a rabbi or an imam or a Buddhist there too?
My understanding was that at the time the only people concerned about the rating system were the Catholics and the National Council of Churches that expressed some concern about the appeals process.
Do you think that they have a conservative effect on the appeals board? I mean, because like not everybody goes to see a movie is Catholic or religious.
No, I don't think they don't sit there in that way at all.
Yeah, well, I was wondering, I mean, the rating system was started nearly 30 years ago, and, you know, you're talking about that transitional time. So 30 years later, do you think that the church still needs to be reassured?
Not so much reassured, but I do know it's been very helpful to the system in some instances where Congress has been questioning how the system works. They've been able to testify and to be outsiders, as it were, to tell of their witness firsthand of the process.
As the chair of the Classification and Ratings Administration of the Motion Picture Association of America, do you feel like you can describe where the line is in sexual content between a PG, an R, and an NC-17?
Well, you know, it's a board decision, and films are viewed in context, and so our guidelines to be found on our website describe the parameters of each rating. And usually, if sexuality or violence is very graphic, it's at least an R. And sometimes, if it's in the opinion of the rating board, they think most American parents should think it should be out of bounds for children and it's patently adult, and then it would be NC-17.
Would you agree with Kirby Dick that gay sexuality is rated more restrictively than heterosexual sexuality?
I certainly don't see that. When you get graphic sexuality, no matter if it's heterosexual or homosexual, the graphics usually lead the board to a certain rating, and it's really the graphics of what it is rather than whether it's hetero or homo.
Does the board have a position on what is more potentially offensive or dangerous, whether it's like sex or violence?
No, you know, with each rating, there are parameters of each rating, and there is a limit to sexuality in one rating and a limit to violence in that same rating, and language as well, and drug content and anything else that a parent cares about. The good part of our ability to give information is that we're able to signal through our rating reasons what the element is that brings the film to that rating. So if something's rated R for violence, you know that the sexuality isn't at an R level. And within that R rating, if it's very, very strong violence, we try to indicate strong pervasive violence. In other words, we try to give the parents as much information within that certain rating as we can as well.
You actually sit in with the board and watch movies, right?
Yes, many times I do.
So what's it like to have to like develop these film watching habits where you're basically probably like timing the length of sex scenes and counting the number of people who have been killed? And
I'm sorry, we don't do that. We don't time them, and we don't count the numbers of people killed. We actually sit and watch the film the way a parent would. And you feel, as a parent, what you think most parents would think was the most appropriate rating for that film. We do have some rules that are articulated, the language rule and the drug content rule, that a use of the an F word is a PG-13 at the minimum, and more than one use is an R, and a sexual use is an R. And those are actual rules. We have very few rule. In other words, we don't have, if you show this for 2 minutes, it's this. Where there might be a misunderstanding is if a filmmaker does not want to release the film with a rating that we've given them, he or she can ask about different ways to edit the film, or ask us what leads us to rate a film a certain way. And it's in those discussions where perhaps some misunderstandings evolve if they're passed on secondhand. For instance, if a sex scene or a long sequence of violence is one of the problems leading to a rating, naturally, one of the solutions to that, to get to another rating, is perhaps to cut down on the length so it won't permeate the film as much. But there's no timing on anything. It's just sometimes that's the way to give another impression of the film, is to reduce the content in some way, either in a graphic way or in a time way.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Joan Graves is the chair of the Motion Picture Association of America's Ratings Board. Coming up, Jeremy Sisto. He was Billy on 6 Feet Under. Now he's starring in the new NBC series, Kidnapped. This is Fresh Air. My guest Jeremy Sisto is best known for his role in 6 Feet Under as Billy Chenoweth, the manic depressive brother of the character Brenda. Now he's starring in the NBC series Kidnapped, which premieres next Wednesday. He plays a private investigator named Knapp, who specializes in rescuing kidnapped victims. The entire season will revolve around one story. In the first episode, the 15-year-old son of wealthy parents is kidnapped and held for a high ransom. The parents, played by Timothy Hutton and Dana Delaney, call in Knapp. In this scene, Knapp explains that if they hire him, there's a few things they should expect.
All right, the first thing I gotta tell you to do is call the FBI.
You should know that option is available to you. The second thing I'll tell you is, whatever you do, don't call the FBI. You see, the FBI's objectives during a kidnapping investigation are to effect the safe return of the subject, along with the identification, apprehension, and prosecution of the kidnappers, as well as the recovery of the ransom payments. All I care about is retrieval. Everything else is a distraction. My fee is non-negotiable, payable upon the safe return of the kidnapped victim, intact.
What does that mean, intact?
It means we don't pay him if Leopold's dead.
From nothing comes nothing.
You're not very good with people, are you, Mr. Knapp?
No, but I'm good at finding them.
That's Jeremy Sisto in his new NBC series, Kidnapped. Jeremy Sisto, welcome to Fresh Air. As a private investigator in Kidnapped, you have to, you know, carry a gun and learn to do the things that action guys do in action TV shows and action movies and stuff. So are these new things for you to learn?
No. I mean, it's you know, on these shows, when there is a gun around, there's inevitably a stunt coordinator who, you know, loves this kind of stuff. And he will spend as long as you want, and most of the time longer, sort of showing you different cool and realistic stances to take with a weapon, and, you know, in sort of physically apprehending a suspect or those kinds of things. So there's that. I think that might have, you know, helped me along the way. But it also comes back to just being a kid and, you know, and kind of the things you imagine doing when you were going to save your parents' life from, you know, I grew up in the 80s, so it was the Russians, and save the lives of your loved ones from the bad guys. So there's some really fun sort of aspects of that fall into the category of just make-believe.
Until now, you've been best known for your role on 6 Feet Under as Billy, who was the troubled, manic, depressive brother of Brenda. And I'm wondering, what are some of the characteristics that you gave him, or some of the things that you understood about manic depression in terms of how somebody would sit or stand, you know, like what their posture would be, the things that you did basically in your speaking and body language to embody the kind of troubled state and the depressed state that your character was often in?
It was a character that I sort of, at least by the end, but definitely throughout, you know, the whole process, came to know very well. And he was manic depressive, and that is that was a big part of him. But I suppose what I understood about this particular guy was was his the character was based all in a discussion of boundaries. He was raised with these obscure boundaries where his parents, you know, sort of sexual relation, their relationship with sex and their sexual relationship with each other and with others, and their understanding of kind of social ideas had sort of obscured, more obscured boundaries than perhaps might be the best way to raise a child in. And so how he turned out, what he went back and forth from is when he was on these meds and he was, you know, sort of, you know, feeling conscious, he had this overcompensated idea of boundaries and of how to perform and how to be, and he became conservative in his approach to the world and his approach to people and how he dealt with himself. And then when he was off, you know, that when he was off his meds and in kind of a manic high, those boundaries that were missing from his understanding kind of allowed for life to be really sexy and really to him to feel really connected to everyone and to feel, as if he was living the way he wanted to live and seeing the world in the way he wanted to see it.
Well, let me play a scene, and this is one of the most memorable moments in your character's life and also in the series. You know, he had been very close with his sister Brenda, but he also did some things to betray her. But in this scene from season 3, you're very depressed. Your sister Brenda is comforting you. You put your head on her shoulder, and then you kiss her on the lips, and she's horrified. And in the next episode, you talk with your sister Brenda about what happened. Let's hear that scene.
Brenda, we have to talk.
No, we don't.
We do.
What is there to say, Billy? What?
I'm in love with you.
Oh, Jesus, don't.
No, I need to say it. I need to say it. I know I can't have you. I know it's wrong to want you like this, but that doesn't make it any less true.
And what am I supposed to do with that?
Nothing. Nothing. I have to let it go. And maybe saying the words will help. I want to let it go. You have to believe that.
It's Jeremy Sisto and Rachel Griffith in a scene from 6 Feet Under. What was your reaction when you saw this in the script, that you were going to have this passionate, incestuous kiss with your sister? And then, of course, you'd have this conversation afterwards. Were you troubled by having this turn of events happen with your character?
I think it was, there was a different spin on it, although, you know, it was a story that took place over 5 years of telling it, and so we got into many different things. So I think when we read this, it was, you know, I remember talking to Rachel and both of us being surprised that they went there to that point and sort of trying to figure out exactly what that point was. In fact, what happened in that particular scene before this when I kissed her was that we did the scene. It was a good scene. And the kiss itself, though, was something that the producers felt was not enough of a open-mouthed kind of kiss that would be between lovers as opposed to friends. And so we went back just to pick up a close-up of the kiss to make sure that sort of that element of the scene was there. So, I mean, that I think tells the story that the actors were tentative about going too far in this respect and perhaps taking away the underlying storyline that was always there and was what made this relationship so intriguing.
It must be strange after several years on 6 Feet Under to start a new series with new writers and new characters, new actors.
Yeah, it's a but you know, on Six Feet Under, I would do about half the season, and maybe 1 or 2 days a week. So it was, you know, it was a supporting role. So I was able to observe things from, you know, slightly, you know, just on the sort of perimeter, just at the edge of the of the family, and so I got to observe, you know, to bring up boundaries again, when boundaries are crossed between the writers and the actors, and sort of how those issues are dealt with, how, you know, the writers and the producers and the actors all live together in this situation.
What do you consider a boundary being crossed between an actor and a writer? Is it when an actor refuses to read a line or refuses to do a plot point or something? Like, what kind of lines can be crossed there?
That's what it is. It seems to me that what happens is after the first season, if it's a success, then the actors come back and they feel fairly close to their characters, and so they have a bit more stronger reactions when they read the script, and they say, oh, no, because, you know, they didn't think about it. They didn't think of it, you know. So they say, oh, I didn't put that into my thoughts, and that's not what my character would do. And so on the second season, there was a bit of that on Six Feet Under, and some sort of steps were taken, and on the third season, those boundaries were reestablished. So that, I think that's the boundaries I'm speaking about.
My guest is Jeremy Sisto. He's starring in the new NBC series, Kidnapped, which premieres next Wednesday. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeremy Sisto. He stars in the new NBC series Kidnapped. He was also one of the stars of HBO's Six Feet Under. I have to ask you about playing Jesus in a movie called Jesus. What do you do to prepare to play Jesus? What do you do, read the Bible? I mean, what do you do to prepare?
Well, fortunately, I did not have a lot of time. That was, you'd think that'd be the first role I cast, but in fact, when they offered me that role, I had to fly out the next day. So there was sort of just enough time to get to know the script well and talk to the director and, yeah, spend some time with the Bible and sort of make my own sort of ties to this interpretation from, you know, from the Bible itself. And other than that, I kind of felt a certain sense of relief if they were willing to cast me as this. And the Roman Catholic Church was involved, so
the Pope John Paul blessed the movie. Right, it was a Vatican screening for Pope John Paul. Were you at that screening with him?
I was, yeah. I mean, not a screening of the film, but screening is also what they say when you get to go see him, right?
Oh, I see. So you were at?
I think.
Did he?
So we went to the Vatican and we went up to the room and then we got to go and sort of kiss his ring or shake his hand, whatever that thing was. It was pretty weird, but it was one of the many sort of unique experiences that I never would have imagined that I would have, you know, had before. So somebody called me up and said, you want to play Jesus Christ?
Right. So of course you get crucified at the end of the movie and spikes are, you know, nailed into your hands, you're up on the cross. What's it like to be crucified as an actor?
There's a little bicycle seat underneath you.
To support you on the cross when you're hanging?
To support me on the cross.
You know something? Kirk Douglas told me that, too, about Spartacus, because I asked him about getting crucified in Spartacus, and he had a bike seat also underneath
him. Yeah, that's what they don't tell you. Crucifixes. You can get a bike seat, which chafes. It's just a very surreal thing to, you know, once you're kind of laughing at the whole situation, that that you're up on this cross, and you know it's the last place you'd ever think, last story you thought you'd be sort of telling. And another side of you is, you know, sort of thinking very deeply about this time, really, that was, you know, that had this kind of brutality. I mean, there's incredible brutality in our world today, and there was incredible brutality back then, and this was some of it. So it was, you know, there's kind of always a mix in kind of film for
sure.
Me.
Well, I understand both parts there, the reflection on the real life of Jesus and on, you know, suffering and hatred in the world. And at the same time, the comedy, especially when you're up there on the cross and you're looking out, and there's Deborah Messing from Will and Grace as Mary Magdalene. And, I mean, there's got to be something funny about that.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing. The whole thing was we had that mix of just laughing at the absurdity of what we were doing and kind of, you know, inspired by it, thought it was a cool sort of interpretation, and we all got it. It was very clear what we were doing. We were doing a Jesus that was not scary and haunting and ghostly, but a Jesus that, you know, in this day and age, you might actually follow because he, you know, there was something that was attractive about him, as, you know, to go against the early interpretations of this creepy dude that you follow through the desert because you thought he was God's son. This was like somebody who was charismatic and so that was the concept. You know, it's not like we were saying it was the way that it happened. It was just sort of an interpretation. It was nice to be on something that knew what it was.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk, but we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jeremy Sisto stars in the NBC series Kidnapped. It premieres next Wednesday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Dell Books, publisher of The Sacred Cut, a modern mystery set in Rome by David Hewson, author of The Villa of Mysteries. From Universal Pictures, presenting The Black Dahlia. From the director of Scarface and the author of L.A. Confidential, The Black Dahlia, in theaters Friday. And from Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start October 2nd. At capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Artie Lang. He's a cast member of The Howard Stern Show, where he's known for his hilarious stories, which are usually about his biggest problems, like his eating and drinking binges and his love life. He co-wrote and stars in the new movie, Beer League. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.